Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Winter begins this Friday, but it's been feeling like winter for much of the past month, and the cold can bring lots of problems. Joining us now with advice on how to deal with those problems and others are Lawrence and Alvin Ubell of Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. Lawrence Ubell is the company's president, chief inspector, licensed in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. He's an EPA-certified lead inspector and assessor in New York. And Alvin Ubell founded Accurate Building Inspections in 1961 and now serves as its vice president and senior inspector. Their company has inspected over 30,000 structures for over 2,000 attorneys, numerous real estate organizations, architectural and engineering firms, and private citizens. And they're here now to offer their expert advice to you, our listeners. You can get that by giving us a call at 212-209-2877. You may be unfamiliar with that number because we haven't been using it all that much, so let me give it out again, and I'll try to repeat it as many times as I can throughout the show. 212-209-2800. And we don't have a screener, so just hang on.
77.
Huh? What did I say? 2877. What did I say?
00.
Oh, I'm so sorry. 212. You gave the wrong number. Don't call that number. 212-209-2877. I don't know what it stands for, 2877. Obviously, it doesn't stand for WBAI, but whatever. 212-209-2877. Give us a call now. Al and Larry, welcome to our show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great being here.
Now, before we get into the to the topics that we can discuss here and getting some calls at 212-209-2877, both of you have given expert testimony in various courts. What does that involve?
Well, it involves to have expertise in a particular field. I, fortunately, have expertise in construction and how construction could in some way injure people, because buildings, in essence, are really dangerous places. I mean, you have a stair that people fall down from, and they have windows that people fall out of. There are sidewalks that have tripping conditions, and much of it is obvious to the owners of this property, but sometimes the owners disregard the dangers, and someone gets injured, and they call someone up like myself to evaluate whether it is a viable case that could be put against the owner of a property.
And then, Larry, you're a lead inspector.
Actually, the lead inspector is – I've actually let that go by the wayside.
Why, because Scott Pruitt came in or
– Well, because the amount – right now I'm licensed – actually, I'm licensed in New York, New Jersey only. And the reason for it is that the amount of continuing ed that one has to keep going to keep all these licensures going – can be onerous, and so I keep with that. But as far as my expertise is I've done quite a number of cases on judging other inspectors. Mm. And so, in other words, someone who will do an inspection and then problems will come up that should have been disclosed during that process, and whether the person actually did the proper job, or actually they were liable for what they did.
We're seeing a lot of that in the NYCHA inspections.
Exactly. There's whether the inspections or actually the work that was done, and we also do that. I do a lot of expert testimony on judging of construction renovations and whether that was done properly.
Now, we're going to talk about different topics that are related to winter. Mm-hmm. You want to say something else? Well, because then I want to take a call.
Just to what Lawrence just came up with and what I'm involved in is that we find that there is none so blind as those that can see, and there's none so blind as those that don't want to see. Mm. And this is, we are able to evaluate what somebody missed or disregarded.
Mm-hmm. We should also have you looking at the way people view politics under those circumstances. Anyway, our number again is 212-209-2877. Let's take a call. Hi, BAI, you're on the air.
What's going on?
Hi.
Hi. I'm with my friend Michael, and he heard you on the radio, and so we're calling.
Great.
He has a kitchen floor that is slanted, like 5 to 10 degrees slanted. Is there a law on a slanting floor in an apartment?
You mean he rents, and whether this is to code or not. That would have to do with how far the slant has actually gone and what the deviation is. You would be able to speak more on that.
Well, but the problem is with slanted floors, that is really a symptom of a problem of a structural problem within the building. The buildings are built level and square and conform to strict measurements to make it comfortable to utilize. Now, if a floor is slanting, something is taking place that the settlement is taking done. The way you can repair a floor is to find out why it's settling is the first important thing. Some exploratory openings maybe have to take in. But leveling off a floor could be hazardous, because sometimes when you have to raise the floor at some place at a doorway, you create a step which is a potential accident waiting to happen.
But so who does she get in touch with, in touch with about that?
Well, if she's a renter of an apartment and something like that, then she should take it, address it to the landlord. And if she lives in an apartment that can be controlled by the city, because I have to tell people this all the time, buildings don't belong to us in the city of New York. Actually, the city owns the building, and the taxes we pay is the rent to own those pieces of property. And so you have to comply with the codes that are not only construction codes, but maintenance codes, and a building has to be free of any potential defects. And that's the responsibility of a landlord.
And if the problem that this person's having, because I'm getting the sense that they're looking for, is the landlord responsible for this? If what they have there with the slanted floor is deemed a hazardous condition, then yes, the landlord is responsible to correct that problem.
Who do they call?
They call HPD. HPD, dial 311 and speak to Housing and Preservation and Development or Buildings Department, and they'll get on it.
Okay. The building's over 100 years old.
The building is what?
It's over 100 years old.
Yeah, and most likely the building was built before there were any codes at all. But still, that doesn't neglect the responsibility of the landlord to keep the premises in safe order.
Yeah, there is a section of the building, New York City Building Code, which is a maintenance code. It's not a construction code, but a maintenance code. Mm-hmm. Means you an owner of property must take care of their building in a reasonably safe way. And if they don't, then they're in violation of the code.
Because they are charging rent.
Yes, rent.
So they have a responsibility mm-hmm. to the person who's paying them.
That's exactly
for that
right.
space. Okay, does that help?
Thank you very much, yes, very much.
Well, thank you.
If you want
thank
to
you
file
very,
a complaint.
Very much.
If you want to file a complaint, the best way to do it is by the 311 call, because then they give you a registration number, and they will direct, the 311 operator will direct it to the right agency.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call. Again, the number is 212-209-2877. My guests are Alvin and Lawrence U. Bell of Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn. And We have a lot of stuff happening right now because mm-hmm. of the winter. I don't know how much of it we can blame on climate change, but we're about to have snow, I gather. We've had snow in some parts of the area already. I've seen a lot of fires recently. I don't know if they're related to the cold weather.
I mean, you're talking about house fires?
Or? Yeah. Well, every day I turn on the news and I see four or five things that are predictable.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is a mugging. Another one is there's a house or a business that's burning somewhere in New York or in New Jersey.
And, you know, there's not a – I mean, I have to say that now that smoking levels have gone down, one of the more what's starting to take its place is the two fire issues that are starting to take its place are candles, and that's why a lot of universities and colleges have banned candles from all dormitories. And the other big cause is improper electrical installations, and mostly that has to do with the use of overloading extension cords. People will buy the cheapest extension cord that's only rated at 6 amperes, and they'll plug everything they own through this one extension cord, and now they'll be running 20 amps through, and the rubber melts, and the electricity and the wires make contact with each other, cause it to arc and spark and cause a fire. There's, in a lot of ways, people are not going around being critical of their own installations, but the thing they can do is actually put smoke detectors in all their livable spaces and sleeping areas. And it's very important. It's really important also the kind of smoke detector. Most people have, and about 90% of the market out there, are ionization smoke detectors. And the problem with those smoke detectors, and this is even by the Consumer Product Safety Commission admits this, that these smoke detectors have a failure rate of between 55 and 60%. That means it works less than it does work. And the fact that we need these things to work only once, you really don't want to have the odds that at two-thirds of the time it's not going to work. So what you really need to do is buy photoelectric smoke detectors, which have a failure rate of only 4%. And I think that 4% is most likely user error. The most important place to put those smoke detectors are in your bedrooms. And 60 to 70% of all fire deaths are from smoke inhalation, and most of them happen at nighttime. When we're sleeping, we don't get up, we dream. If you're awake and you smell smoke, you'll do something. If you're asleep, you'll think your brain does very weird things, and you'll think you're at a barbecue. Like I've left the TV on at night, and I've had a great conversation with George Clooney. So, I mean, this is how our minds work. You need to have photoelectric smoke detectors in every bedroom. It's very important. Putting it in the hall is ridiculous. No one sleeps in the hall.
But some of them work too well. I have one in a kitchen in an apartment that I rent.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime I cook, if I don't put on the exhaust fan, it's almost guaranteed that even a little bit of smoke is going to set that thing off, and it's almost impossible to turn it on. I have to open the window. I have to fan the smoke alarm. It is.
But you just indicated a problem. That's an ionization smoke detector. I could tell from here, because the problem is they go off when you cook, but when you actually have a real fire, they don't. The ionization seep fine particulate matter, which comes off of toast, which comes off of fry, which comes off from a steamy shower, they'll go off. So you think something works, and in fact it doesn't when it needs to. The other problem is you don't need a smoke detector in a kitchen. You need a fire sensor. What you need in the kitchen is a telephone, because if there's a fire in the kitchen, you probably started it. Okay, so you don't need that. You need photoelectric, and you need to look. How can you tell? Get your magnifying glasses out. Take off your smoke. Take the smoke detector off the wall with the magnifying glass. Read if it says anything about radioactive material. Mercurium 241. If it says that, it's an ionization smoke detector. Get rid of it and buy yourself a photoelectric smoke detector.
My guests are Lawrence and Alvin Ubell. This is Leonard Lopate at Large. Our call-in number is 212-209-2877. And let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, what's up?
That's me.
Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to note one question. An inspector told me a radiator is not required in a room you do not sleep in.
No, that's not true, but it's not required in a room that doesn't have an exterior wall. So if you have an exterior wall, you kind of do need heat in there.
And all of the walls I'm mentioning that I showed him are exterior walls. They face the street.
This sounds like a case you're going to do something about an inspector who's giving out false information.
Well, no. Are you talking about a city inspector, or are you talking about a
property? That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I knew she was.
Code enforcement.
Yeah, because he's deeming this room as a non-bedroom, but that makes no sense because a living room, technically, you don't sleep in either, and you need a radio there also. You know, I mean, you need a radiator there also. We could have an argument, the two of us, but since he's the last word.
Well,
maybe,
one of the problems is I don't have one in the bathroom, which is horrid.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing.
That's really horrible.
Here's the thing. I would call up 311 again and get a different inspector. You may get a different opinion.
That's right.
I'm serious. You may get a different opinion.
Okay, that's true. Now, I have one, make one other statement.
Sure.
311 may be fine, but after that, you can hang it up. I've been doing it for 26 years, okay?
Go ahead.
And right now, we have no heat. Okay, we had scalding water for 5 days. Now we have no hot water at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everybody in the world has been here. What is the building evaluator from HPD, Neighborhood Preservation?
Well,
I don't understand what that is.
Well, the HPD is the Housing Preservation Development, which is
I
mostly,
know that, but what
which
is the building
mostly,
evaluator?
It's mostly for multiple dwellings, three or more residential buildings, but when you have a one or two family house, it is a completely different department that takes
right.
care
now
of that.
Now this is a 13 unit building.
Then that's a HPD, and you just right. got to keep pounding away at them and making sure
for
that. Let me listen, and make sure that you copy down the exact number that you registered. The operator will give you a number of the call
right.
that you should
right.
keep on a pad and the date that you took it. And then what happens is, if you collect a sufficient amount of them, I would send it to some newspaper or call up the New York Times or call up the Post or the News or someone that all of a sudden, or even a radio station or a television station, that it becomes newsworthy that the agency that is working for you, because you're a citizen, is not responding to something that affects
well,
your
you
life.
Know, HPD has been in the paper for years.
So
right
now
they have.
Well, I have another suggestion. I have another suggestion. Maybe you and your fellow tenants should get advice of counsel and have a rent strike.
That's it.
You know,
most of them are students. They're not about to strike. They
okay.
need a place to stay while they're going to school.
That's it sounds to me like you might have to move.
No. That's not an answer. The answer is that you have to pound away at this agency until all of a sudden somebody brings up the flag.
I am continuing. It's
all
moving,
right.
but it's not moving fast enough.
I know.
Oh, sorry
you know
about
I mean?
That.
You got to persevere.
Yeah, okay.
But every time, I'm going to say, to go along with what my father says, every time there's a problem, you're on the phone. Every time there's an
That's
issue,
right.
you're on the phone.
311. They know my name very well.
I'm sure they do. Have a great day.
Thank you for calling us. And the number she called is 212-209-2877. We have another caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a floor problem. Years ago, there was a flood in my apartment. So I have some water damage on a very, like a 3x4 area of the floor. It's oak flooring,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to be warped.
Mm-hmm.
You can only, so just a little bit, you only notice it if you run your hand or foot
mm-hmm.
across the board, the crosswise.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like the boards are not as flush as elsewhere on the floor. It's like there's this tiny long space between them. Can that be corrected by sanding?
Yes. When was the last time you had the floors refinished?
Never.
So now's a great time.
It's now or never.
No, now would be better than never.
It also depends upon when the flood took place. You have to give it a time to
Well, how
dry
long
up.
Ago? Well, let's ask. When did the flood happen?
About 15 years ago.
I think time has passed.
Oh, it's dried out by now.
Yes, I think it's dried out. I think what you should do is just contract with a floor finisher and have them, sand the floor down to make it even. But I'm also going
to
say
could she go to an insurance company and
not 15
or is it,
years later?
It's too late.
I should have done it
15 years ago.
I think everything is passed by now. You know,
rental.
It's a rental. So you're paying it for your own good unless you can, get the your landlord to do it. And then he would. But I have to say, if you're talking about one room, you're talking about an expenditure of probably about $500 to have it resanded and re-polyurethaned or hard waxed or whatever you want to do with the floor.
On the other hand, if it is something that is irregular that could cause a trip hazard, then the landlord should be able to fix that, because that's a violation and it violates not only the residential housing code, but also the maintenance code.
But Alvin, if it happened 15 years ago, by now hasn't the statute of limitations on tripping already
No,
passed?
That stays forever.
Because the problem still exists.
I
don't think it's dangerous. Hardly noticeable.
Okay, so for all you people who are in her boat, but it is dangerous, you can get the landlord to fix it.
Yes.
Otherwise.
Okay. Do I have to sand the whole floor, or can I just do that part? Would that be wrong to just do that?
You can just do that part. I mean, you really can. It won't. I mean, obviously the finish won't match.
It won't
match. But we're talking aesthetics here, not necessarily. You know,
yeah, but if you want the whole room to look the same,
you're going to have to do everything.
Because then when they stain
one
it again.
One will be a different color than the other.
And the big problem is that most people who live in New York City apartments have way too much stuff, and it's hard to clear it out to get to the floor. The floor. I know. I hear it. I hear it from here.
it would be a project. But, okay, last two questions. Polyurethane, is there a more natural alternative to polyurethane, like a shellacking or waxing or something?
Yes, there's what I did in my house. It was a product called Rubio Monocoat, having nothing to do with the great senator from Florida. But this is a material which is green. It comes from plants. It smells like broccoli when they put it on. But what it does is it goes into the floor and it oxidizes the floor, so it tends to have this gray finish instead of that orangey red finish that all oak floors look like. If you've ever been to Restoration Hardware, their floors are that same kind of color, and then what they do is they push in a hard wax into the grain, and it makes the grain pop a little bit. It's very attractive, and you don't have. And if you scratch it or do anything, all you have to do is just sand it out and put more stuff on it, and it blends right in. With polyurethane, you tend to, once you scratch it, it's like scratching plexiglass. It never goes away.
Yeah, but if you do use polyurethane, don't use the shiny stuff. Use the what they call the satin finish and polyurethane, because the scratches won't show up as readily.
And also now they use polyurethane, which is not as explosive as it used to be. That was a problem also back in the good old days. They do polyurethane and it would outgas, and all of a sudden a motor from your refrigerator would start off, cause a spark, and the whole place would ignite. Right? So that was a problem too. So make sure that they use the right kind of polyurethane so we don't blow up the building.
Okay.
Is details. This a potential do-it-yourself project, or does it? Should
I mean, you can. I just have to say that sanding
rent
a floor,
sander?
The sander, one of those big drum sanders. If you haven't have experience to it, you could stuck in one place and you could gouge a nice big hole in it. So if you're not really good at it, you don't want to start the first time. I always my joke is the difference between a professional and an amateur is a professional gets to make mistakes on other people's stuff.
Okay, thank you very much.
No problem. And
thank you so much. We're going to go to another call. The number is 212-209-2877. Hello. Say hello to Larry and Al Ubell.
Hi.
Hi, Larry and Al.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I have two questions.
Yes.
And I like your information about the smoke detectors. And one of the questions is, I'd like to hear some information about what you feel is the best kind of smoke detector, because I was told that maybe the electric ones are the better ones. But my immediate question is about my front door to my apartment in terms of fire code and fire safety. I've been living in this apartment since 1975, and the co-op is getting ready to do hallway renovations. And one of the things I was thinking about was a new front door, because I'm curious to know that since 1975, have the regulations on the fire safety code doors changed? Do I still have the same door?
Well, if this is a multiple dwelling and it has three or more apartments, if it has multiple apartments, the door to each apartment has to be a fireproof door, and it also has to have a peephole in it, and it has to have your
It does.
Well, let me ask you a question: Is it a metal door?
Yes, it's a metal door. It's just old.
Then what Alvin was saying was, a door has to be not a fireproof door. There's nothing in the world that's fireproof. Everything burns.
Fire resistant
door or fire rated door.
That's true.
And the rating of the door is either 1 hour or 2 hours. I'm not sure which one it is. And that's the amount of time that it would take fire to get through that door. You're not going to get much more of a fire rating than 1 or 2 hours, because if you're not out of that apartment in 1 or 2 hours, It's kind of game over, unfortunately. But
okay, so I need to find out what rating the current door is.
Right. But also there's an interesting thing about buildings in general in New York City is that buildings only have to comply to the code under which they were built. And so a building that was built in 1917, which was the first full year of the New York City, the first building code of 1916. We've had other codes since then, 1916, 1938, and now the
2008
and the 2014 code that we 2014 code that we have now. But if your building was built in 1917, it only has to comply to that code. And so it's not required, because if we had to upgrade every building when they changed the code, you would have to rip buildings down because they couldn't comply. You know, what they're doing with your hallways and renovation, as far as the doors are concerned, the changing of the doors will be more of for an aesthetic reason than because any door they would build, install, that's fire rated would probably be a better door than you have now. But if your door is a metal door, it's already a fire rated door.
As far as
let me get to that smoke detector question.
Yeah.
Is that I don't really care whether it's battery or hardwired, as long as the technology is correct, which is photoelectric. I don't care what brand it is, because they all have to meet the certain standard of that particular technology. And so it's photoelectric. I also have to say the Nest Protect smoke detector, which are very expensive. I think they're $150, where most smoke detectors are between $30 and $50. But that's a smart detector where it can tell the difference between smoke and heat and moisture and so on, and it puts out information. It also has a great night light on it when you walk by it. But that point notwithstanding, you know, depending. But as long as you get a photoelectric and you put it in your bedroom, that's what I'm looking for.
Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, what's
Hello?
Up?
Yeah,
what's
go
up?
Ahead.
Oh, okay, that's me. You hear me okay?
Yes.
We hear you great.
Okay. First, I would just like to say that it's great to hear Leonard back in my ears. Mm-hmm. I was a little distant from this program for a while, and the other station begins with an N. And you were talking about smoke alarms.
Detectors, yes, and alarms, yes.
Yeah, and then you mentioned fire sensors.
Mm-hmm.
I have a situation in the boiler room, the heater room, where once it caught on fire, and I'm investigating sprinkler systems with, like, water.
Mm-hmm.
That'll destroy a lot, so I don't want to do that. It's just a water sprinkler system.
Right.
But I came across, most plumbers don't know about it, but I came across a plumber that says there's actually a system that puts out the senses the fire and then puts it out with more of what would come out of a fire extinguisher.
Yes.
What's that called, please?
Well, I'm not sure the name of it, but it sounds like something similar to what they have over both a chemical extinguisher, like they have over at gas stations, over the fuel pumps, or they also have over cooking grills in restaurants. Because if there's a fire in a restaurant, they pull the lever, and all of a sudden all this chemical material comes out, because you don't want to put water on a grease fire or on a gasoline fire, because it really does.
But you can have either foam or carbon dioxide.
Yeah, you can have something like that installed.
Are they okay to breathe in?
Well, you wouldn't be in the boiler room.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about a room. Is this a boiler room that's actually a room, or is it a space that's part of a basement, or is a space part of your livable space?
No, it's a space that is above, actually, the bathroom and the washer room, but it's not that large. It's, say, 8x8.
But I'm going to say the other possibility would be to actually get a limited central station alarm system where you're not going for the safety aspect of it, but you're going for the communication aspect of it, and put in a heat sensor in the boiler room and also a natural gas sensor in the boiler room. So if you have a gas leak, it'll sense that gas leak and send an alarm. Or if you have a heat situation in there, it'll send an alarm. You know, because you don't, and you could have a smoke detector in there too, because that's different than a kitchen. In a kitchen, you're supposed to make smoke because you're cooking and frying and all that kind of thing. In a boiler room, you're not supposed to have smoke. All the smoke's supposed to be going up the chimney. So if you have smoke in a boiler room, you got a problem.
There's one more with the in a restaurant.
Yeah.
That is something that's not automatic if nobody's in the restaurant.
Yeah, but I'm going to say just say my knowledge of this is very limited. And when I mean very, I don't know a lot. and I don't mind saying when I don't know. But I can't imagine that they don't have a situation there where you can have that connected to a heat sensor, that when the sensor gets a positive relay, a positive
it's
alert.
It's a high level, like maybe a fire.
Yeah, it will set it off.
Alvin?
Yes.
You wanted to add to that?
Well, there is a lot of things that go on in a restaurant situation. They have carbon dioxide. They have a device that automatically, if the temperature goes up too much, it shuts off the gas. That also shuts off the gas. In other words, you want to stop the fuel from flowing. And a good system will, if it's a boiler room and all of a sudden there is some sort of odd condition taken by high sulfur dioxide, smoke, whatever it is, it shuts off the fuel to the boiler.
How much is this going to cost our caller?
Oh, a lot of money.
But I would start. I'm going to say I would start to research restaurant fire extinguisher systems and start there. That's where I would start my research.
A little oddly, and thanks so much for your information.
Yeah.
And a little oddly with this thing, it was actually an electric fire. The wires caught fire.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if the gas was involved off the pilot at all, but that's what happened. And somebody actually was near there, noticed some, you know, and went up and did it with the fire extinguisher.
Well, I'm also going to say that sometimes a lot of times when you look at a regular gas boiler, you'll see wires that are in front of the firebox, and normally there's not a lot of heat there. But if for some reason the gas valve is not firing properly, you'll get what we call puff back or flame rollout, and that flame rollout could melt the wires, and that could have been a part of what happened.
Thank you for your call.
Anyway, thank you for calling and listening.
And we are taking calls for Alvin and Lawrence U. Bell at 212-209-2877. Hi, you're on Leonard Lopate at Large.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What's up?
We're
listening.
Yeah, I'm glad you're back on WBAI. I spoke to you close to 40 years ago when you were having two Israelis talk about the difference between American and Israeli politics. And when I called in, you kept me on the line for like 2 hours.
Third
expert.
That was very generous. I can't do that anymore.
That was
a long time ago.
Okay, what do you want to talk to the Ubels about?
What I want to talk about is their advice is so good.
Yes. Over
Thanksgiving weekend, we had no water at all in the building, and I called 311, and it was EPA who got on immediately on this environment protection.
Yes,
and got us water back within 24 hours.
That's fantastic. That's
great. Nice to hear.
And your advice is very good. In a completely unrelated thing, I called 311 when a cat of mine passed away, and they got me help by getting this. I couldn't understand why it happened so suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
I had an appointment with a vet for the next morning. and they got me to do a complete autopsy. I know it's called something else with an animal.
It's called a catopsy?
No, it's called a necropsy.
Oh, it really has
yeah.
a name?
Yeah, it's, yeah, it's not called an autopsy. It's called a necropsy.
What
I know this because my daughter's a vet.
I want people to know that calling 311 can get you really help. There's this idea that a civil servant won't go out of their way, and they will.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Civil servants have a bad reputation they should not have. And the one other comment that I want to tell people is when you call, do not hesitate being the person who's the contact person for 311. That I'm in a 31-suite building, and no one else in the building, while we were all unhappy with no water, would be the contact person. You can't be a coward if you want things to improve.
I agree. You got to stand up and talk and make notice.
And anyway. I want to thank you very much for that positive response.
And let's take another call. You're on Leonard Lopate at Large, talking to Alvin and Lawrence U. Bell.
Hey, what's
Hello?
Up? Yeah,
yes.
What's up?
Yes. Good afternoon. I wanted to make a comment about ionization smoke detectors.
You sure?
Another problem besides their tendency to fail, the high tendency.
Okay, I think that's a pretty big one, but go on.
Yes, but the disposal, municipalities are not set up to dispose of radioactive waste, and all of this stuff goes into the regular landfills.
You're 100% correct.
There is a company that I found on the internet called CuriPak, which will take your ionization detectors, and you have a nominal shipping fee, but they will take it. You can mail it to them and have it properly disposed of. So I just wanted to bring it to the attention.
You know, you're exactly correct. That's the other thing. We have a bunch of radioactive material, like he said, americium 241 isotope.
Yes.
And it can really pollute our groundwater and our landfills. And you're exactly correct. So a double whammy. They don't work and they're bad for us. So two reasons.
Right, and
photoelectric.
While a given detector may have a small amount. If you multiply it by the numbers produced each year, mm-hmm. you end up with a very high quantity of radioactive material entering our environment. Oh,
you're right. Boy. You're right. You're exactly correct. Thank you so much for calling in and telling us.
And let's take another call. Our number 212-209-2877. Hi. Speak to the U-Bells.
Hi.
They just spoke about a fire detector. What are you supposed to do with it in the city of New York if you don't have the address for that company?
Call. You know what? I'm going to say what I say to a lot of other things. It's a fire detector. Call the fire department. Really?
I should give it to them?
That's what I would do. I mean, every time you have
some... I dispose them. I have a bunch of old ones. I'm afraid to throw it in the garbage.
Yeah, call the fire department. See what they say.
And also, how come in New York City there's no, like, recycling program for old televisions and old electronics?
Well, I think
they do.
Yes, it's just...
But they don't tell you about it very often.
You know what I'm going to say? This is really good. Two text alerts. One is for alternate side of the street parking. Every morning and every afternoon, I get alert from the Department of Traffic about what the alternate siding is for the next day, so I know if I have to park or not. And the other one is the Department of Sanitation. You can get on their Twitter alert, and they will send you every day that what's going on with them, when recycle is. Like, for instance, I got a Twitter the other day that they're not picking up recycle, and this was after I think it was after Thanksgiving. So it's good to know. They also let you know when they're having their compost giveaways, when they're also collecting electronic equipment. So, yes, they do that, but they don't do it all the time. It's not like they pick up...
Once in 6 months.
Do you have to request it?
No, they'll tell you when it is and where it is. And right. But go on their website. They will tell you.
And,
I know, they don't make it easy. I got you. Well, but you know what?
Like
this is New York City. It's supposed to be a little tougher than that.
You know, they used to have, go on.
They used to have years ago the bulk collection once a month.
Yeah.
You know, you put out the big stuff and they would come take it.
Well, actually, in my neighborhood where I live on the Great Island of Staten, every Monday night or Tuesday is our big pickup. And I once said, can I put a water heater out? And the guy said, sure, we'll take it. And he says, chances are it won't be here by the time we get here because someone else will take it. But I think bulk collection is pretty much, they'll put it out on your bulk day. There are 2 days. It's the bulk day and the non-bulk day. Find out which one is yours, and that's also available on their website.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. Have a great.
And you're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Our number here, if you want to speak to Alvin and Lawrence Hugh Bell, is 212-209-2877. Let's take another call. Go ahead.
Hello. It's so great to have Leonard and the ULLs back on the air.
Thank you.
I want to ask, I have friends who go away in the winter, and we had a debate of whether you should shut off the water, because sometimes the electric goes off during storms.
Mm-hmm.
What's your opinion of turning the water off and draining the house while you're away from it? Because someone said the oil burner sometimes has water flow into it.
And by the way, I want to add to that, what about keeping a little bit of heat going so that the pipes don't freeze?
Well, first of all, let's understand about the thermostats in certain buildings. Most thermostats don't let you go into the you cannot turn the thermostat down that low that it will go into the freezing point for the building. Thermostats stop at a certain degree, like about at 40 or 50 degrees, and you can't make them any lower. Go ahead.
My feeling is that if you're talking about a summer house or a house that you use periodically in the wintertime, my feeling is that you do turn the heat down as low as the thermostat will allow, and you shut off the water going into the house. So therefore, if you have a failure, whether it's electrical or a heating failure of some sort, you may get a broken pipe anyway, but it won't let the water continue to flow because you've shut off the water. The other thing is that to make it better, you could actually partially drain the house. You don't have to completely drain the house. That way, again, your heat is on, but if you have a failure, it won't do as much damage. And to be on the safe side, you could put I don't want to call it antifreeze because I'm not really thrilled. If it's a summer house, I don't really want you throwing glycol down into the
septic
system. But they do make a more environmentally friendly antifreeze, and you can put that in all the sink traps and all the toilets and all the tub traps and shower traps and so on, so you don't get freezing. But I am not, especially if you're going to use the house, I'm not a big fan of shutting everything off, but I am a big fan of shutting off the well pump and shutting the water into the house. And that way, if there is a catastrophic failure, it's not more catastrophic.
There's also another level. If you shut off the water and you open up the valves of the building and flush the toilets and everything else, what happens is the back pressure from the pump is no longer on. So therefore, you don't have 40 or 50 or 60 pounds pressure on the pipe. So if the pipe does freeze, it won't rupture the pipe.
Yeah, if you open up the valves around the house before you leave, that'll relieve a lot of the pressure also. I also, on that same kind of note, as far as I think that one of the things I've noticed about construction here in the city is people are willing to accept heating systems that are subpar. And that's really, everyone loves that, you know, they think it's a great thing that you're getting your heat and your air conditioning through the same equipment. And I have to tell you,
they can be very noisy, by the way.
Exactly. They're noisy, and forced air heat it's noisy, which is my biggest pet peeve, but my second equally biggest pet peeve, it's very dehumidifying. And like, we have like a day like today where it's cold out, maybe the relative humidity is 20 or 25%, and now we're taking that dry air and putting it through a dehumidifier. So you can write notes on your skin. It gets so dry in people's houses. It kills your sinuses. And also the fact that when you put heating and air conditioning in the same system, you're compromising because everything you do for heating, you do 180 degrees opposite for air conditioning. You heat from down low. You air condition from up high. You heat from the perimeter. You air condition from the core. So how are you going to get these two opposite things to work great together? And you know what? They don't. They don't. They kind of. And the funny thing is that all of these systems I see, they go toward the air conditioning side to make that better, but we heat more months than we air condition. So I completely don't understand that. What they should really be doing is having two separate systems, a hot water heating system, which you don't hear, it's completely silent, and regular forced air conditioning for the summertime for those 3 or 4 months that we need it.
So the old-fashioned thing, a radiator and an air conditioner in the window, that is preferable?
No, I don't like the air conditioner in the window. It's too noisy.
That's very noisy.
It's very noisy. I like the ductless units work really well. They're not very visually attractive, but they work because they're nice and quiet. But the other alternative is a traditional ducted system, basically talking two systems. What I have to say, the inspections that I do of houses where people renovated them for themselves, they do it right. The one where someone's trying to sell something to someone else, they do it the cheap way.
Thank you for your call. We want to get a couple more calls in here. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about a Whirlpool oven, which I now own, as opposed to a stove, which for about a year I felt deathly ill whenever I was in my kitchen and had felt like I needed to run to my window to breathe fresh air, and they finally found a slight gas leak in the tubing that led from the stove into the wall.
Oh, that's
so
bad.
Now they replaced it with a Whirlpool oven, which when they is self-cleaning, and a Whirlpool gas range, and it was so the stench coming out of the fumes of the self-cleaning chemicals was so severe that that made me sick. And then I looked in the manual and saw that the health of some birds is extremely sensitive to the fumes given off, and exposure to the fumes may result in death of certain birds. Always move birds to another closed and well-ventilated room. And that this should disappear after the first few times of using the oven. It still hasn't disappeared. I've learned how to never bake anymore, which is very depressing
in the winter
when you want to bake squash. Any suggestions? I called EPA. I called 311.
I'm going to just say that a self-cleaning oven that gives off gases is basically operating as designed, because you're taking everything that's stuck to the walls of the oven and you're heating them up to burn them off. So when something's burning, it creates gases. So the problem really is having a very well-ventilated kitchen, which is another one of my pet peeves, where no one puts exterior vents in their kitchens. So, like, for instance, I have a self-cleaning oven. When I do it, I have my cooktop running, which puts a negative pressure in the kitchen and sucks all the fumes out, so my whole house doesn't smell like the cooking gases, the gases from the self-cleaning oven. It's a problem. Self-cleaning ovens are not great in non-ventilated or poorly ventilated spaces.
But you would think that the chemical smell of the product that they coat the oven with should eventually wear off, and it never has in my oven.
Well, I don't know if the question really is that the chemical smell, or is it the smell of the combination with the cooking?
I've never baked in my oven. I'm afraid.
So why
the chemicals are so strong?
Have you called a manufacturer to find out?
Yes.
And
they completely disconnected me over and over again because they, I guess, felt it was a legal issue, and they were scared, I guess.
Well,
I mean, I literally could make no headway in any way, shape, or form with anybody who I called to ask, why has the EPA allowed such a product to be put in human beings' food source, that kind of a chemical?
Well, I can't really answer to that issue. But ventilate the kitchen.
Without being in the kitchen yourself.
Yeah, without seeing what's going on.
Thank you so much for your call. We're going to try to sneak one more call in here.
Yeah, we would have to see something in it. And I would scrape some of the material off and send it to a lab to find out why it's is off-gassing like that.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
What's going on?
That's a caller with the floor that was warped. I think she said she was a renter, I believe.
Right? Yeah, she did.
She can't do a thing without the landlord's permission.
Yeah, I know.
Your father has that famous story where the renter had to put up the old cabinets, if you remember. They put the new cabinets. She can't do a thing. Unless when she moves out, she may have to restore the bump, you know.
Yeah, I know that.
Do a thing.
So I'm just going to
say. And if she's putting that polyurethane or something that catches on fire or whatever.
Yeah, but I would assume that the landlord would appreciate her making the property more valuable.
So to go back to your original thing, if she goes to the landlord and said, you give me permission to fix the floor, and he says yes, okay, that's a non-issue.
Get it in writing.
Yeah, yeah. And if the woman's listening, get it in writing.
All right.
Have a great
day.
That's
my comment for today. Bye now. Okay.
And thank you so much. And we're pretty much out of time, but I wanted to cover a few other things. You suggest, you have a tip here. You say that people should spray shovels with a soapy lubricant before they shovel to make the job easier. We're going to be seeing a lot of snow this year.
That's an old trick that I did. In fact, I demonstrated that on Good Morning America many, many years ago, where we shoveled out snow in front of ABC, and what we did was I had one with the snow stuck to the shovel, and then I sprayed it with some liquid that I had on, and you saw the snow just slide right off the shovel, each and every shovel, and that became
Pam. You know,
Pam is good.
You know, for cooking, that works good. You can even use some WD-40. I mean, the amount you're spraying on is not going to hurt the environment.
Any other tips before we say goodbye?
Another tip would be do you have a tip that would be appropriate? All I can say
I'm more into the thing where if you're doing renovations, ventilate your bathrooms, ventilate your kitchens, even if they have windows. No one opens a window ever, so put a ventilator in, and it will reduce the mold, reduce the smell, make your apartment or house smell better.
Yes, and all those people who have windows and have children, and their apartment is above the third floor or greater, make sure you have window guards. That is absolutely
necessary. By the
way,
second floor, too. You're not required, but you should.
That good point.
And it's been so much fun having the two of you here.
It's been great being back with you.
I'm sure we'll have you again in a couple of months, right?
Not a problem. We're available.
Okay. So
we don't do anything all day. We stare at each other.
Yeah. Alvin and Lawrence Hugh Bell, Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York.
Thanks. Thank you so much. Take care.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Lawrence and Alvin Hugh Bell, to Reggie Johnson, who is at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps make things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.